Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Last week, we did questions from our patrons, our supporters at TrentHornPodcast.com. And I wasn't able to get through all the ones that I selected I thought were really interesting. So I thought, why not dive into some more of those questions? Because I haven't done an open mailbag episode. Well, I mean, I did one last week, but before that, it felt like several months had gone by before I had done an open mailbag. And we've been covering a lot here at the podcast. And I'm really grateful. I really want to give a shout out to our patrons at TrentHornPodcast.com. We're really growing here. We're able to do more interviews, debates, and dialogues. I love doing four episodes a week, and I want to be able to keep it that way. Though I'm kind of praying right now, and if you could pray for me, I would appreciate this, just to find balance in a lot of things that I'm doing, because I want to get back into writing. I'm finishing up a book right now, and I want to really put out more books, including higher-level content books on specific apologetic content. I think what I'm struggling with is you can't do everything. So something's going to have to give. I don't want it to have to be the podcast ever. At worst, I might, you know, dial back an episode each week, maybe only three episodes a week instead of four. But I like the routine that we have with four a week. And I want to keep, as long as I'm producing good content that is edifying people, helping them to grow in their faith and also to help people better understand the Catholic faith and to answer objections to it. But, you know, so I want to find that sort of balance, but I love writing. Writing, debating is probably my number one favorite thing. Writing is probably number two. That's why I think the thing I'm probably going to be dialing back a little bit more is speaking. I love going out and speaking and meeting and seeing people, but it's just hard, like travel and going places. It kind of throws a monkey wrench into kind of the production schedule I have each week of doing four episodes. I want to do more rebuttal videos, more public dialogues and debates. All those things, they take a lot of time, and travel, going to the airport. Time is just a very finite and precious thing that I have. And the thing I really want to focus on are doing the podcasts and writing more books. But yeah, I'm really grateful to our supporters, because you're making all this possible to help the Council of Trent podcast really grow. We've gotten a lot of reviews on iTunes, Google Play. Leave a review there if you have a chance. That's always really helpful. And by word of mouth, people are hearing more about the podcast. And I say praise be to God, especially if it can build up someone's faith or introduce a non-Catholic to the Catholic faith. So thanks to our patrons at TrentHornPodcast.com. If you want to support the podcast, get access to our Catechism video study series, New Testament video study series, and get to submit questions to episodes like these, then definitely check out TrentHornPodcast.com. All right, here are the questions I didn't get to in the last open mailbag. Let's have some fun with them here. By the way, philosophy jargon alert, but I will I'll dial it down a little. Here's a question. How do we distinguish a substance sortal, S-O-R-T-A-L, from a phase sortal, S-O-R-T-A-L? For instance, if someone claims that being a sperm and or egg is just a phase sortal of the substance human being, how do we refute that claim and instead establish that a new substance comes into being at conception, keeping in mind that sperm and egg, too, are ordered to becoming adult human beings in a sense? All right, so what's going on here? The question is, when we undergo change, we'll leave the word sortal out of this so it's not as confusing. When we undergo change, there's two different kinds of changes that we can undergo. We can undergo accidental change or substantial change. Okay, so if I cut off the top of my hair, I'm going to undergo an accidental change. I'm still Trent Horn. I still exist. If I cut off my curly locks, I will just be Trent Horn with a buzz cut, and I'm not sure that would work. That would work for me. So if I cut off the top of my hair, that would be an accidental change. Trent Horn still exists. If I cut off my head, the top of my head, top of my body, my head, right at my neck, given the technology we currently possess, I would undergo a substantial change. Trent Horn, the person, would no longer exist. Instead, what would happen is I would die, my soul would leave my body, and instead of the person Trent Horn, who is a composite of soul and body, you would have the body of Trent Horn and the soul of Trent Horn separated from one another. And so the human person, the human being who is a composite of soul and body would cease to exist if I cut my head off and then died. That would be a substantial change. So the question is, how do we know sperm and egg undergo a substantial change at conception rather than an accidental change? And what I would say is, well, look at the properties of the entities that are involved. What does it mean to be a sperm or an egg? What are the essential features of sperm and egg? And what are the essential features of being a human being? And if you gain or lose essential features, i.e. things you have to have in order to exist, then that's a substantial change or a substance sortal, if you will. So what does it mean to be a sperm or an egg? It means that you have approximately 23 chromosomes and that you exist as long as you are in a nutrient-rich environment, but you are incapable of growth on your own. What does it mean to be a human being, to be a zygote, to be a blastocyst, an embryo, a fetus? Well, it means you have approximately 46 chromosomes. And then in my pro-life classes, I give this acronym, the NET test. What does it mean to be an organism rather than an organ? Why is a zygote an organism, but a sperm and an egg, they're not organisms? An organism is an individual living thing, and it is that if it passes the NET test. What that means is if I give this living thing nutrients, environment, the right environment, and time, does it have the capacity to develop into a mature human being or into a mature member of a species? Puppies, kittens, infants, embryos, bacterium, fungi. These things, if I give them nutrients, the correct environment, you know, plants got to grow in the ground, humans need air, a mixture of nitrogen and oxygen, or at least has to have oxygen, at least, well, 21% I think is ideal, but I think you can go as low as 16 maybe. I don't know. That would be a question for a doctor or a chemist to answer. Right environment, nutrients, and time. But sperm, egg, cancer cells, skin cells, you give them any nutrients, put them in any environment, give them any amount of time, they will always be the same thing. They do not have the capacity. The only substantial change they undergo is when their cellular components break apart and they die. Their cell walls rupture and their internal organelles, the little parts within the organs themselves, dissolve and resolve away. So I cover this a little bit more in my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, but I hope that's helpful to see that the change that sperm and egg undergo, that sperm cannot become a human being. It does not develop into a mature human being because it's not a human being. It needs the egg and vice versa. My skin cells cannot become a human being unless they undergo a substantial change by taking the DNA out of the skin cell and putting it into a human egg that has been denucleated or has had the genetic material taken out of it. Okay? So either way, you cannot get a human being with just nutrients, environment, and time. You would need a substantial change to the thing's identity. All right, here's the next one. Since we don't have the ability to sin in heaven, how did the angels fall? Well, it's commonly believed that the angels did not possess the beatific vision, did not possess the full and complete communion with God. This is something so that God would allow them to make a single choice at their creation, whether to serve him or to not serve him. Now, angels, because they don't have bodies, are not tempted to corporal sins like lust or something like that, but they would have intellectual sins, chief among them the sin of pride. So this is what Aquinas says. I answer that without doubt the angel, Lucifer, the devil, sinned by seeking to be as God. But this can be understood in one of two ways. First, by equality. Secondly, by likeness. The devil could not be as God in the first way. By natural knowledge, he knew that this was impossible. And he goes on. So the point is, how could you be as God? Well, you could literally be God, except that even the devil knows he'll never be all-knowing, he'll never be all-powerful, he'll never have those infinite qualities because he's a finite creature. But you could be as God in the likeness of God, in that you could act in ways similar to God and try to usurp attributes that are only proper to him. So the devil tempted Adam and Eve, saying, oh, eat the fruit, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. They're not the standard of good and evil, but they want to try to determine good and evil for themselves in the same way that God determines good and evil in virtue of his perfect nature. Or the devil might want to be worshipped and be the source of adoration for people. So in that sense, he would be in the likeness of God by illicitly usurping or unlawfully taking something that doesn't belong to him, namely having complete devotion and obedience, adoration above all things. That belongs to God alone, and the devil might have wanted that. That's why it's interesting in Philippians 2, verses 6 through 11, that great hymn that Paul shares, it's also called the kenosis hymn, the outpouring hymn. It says that Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as a thing to be grasped. Jesus was in the form of God, but he wasn't hanging on to it as if he didn't rightfully own it because it was his. He set aside what was lawfully his to become like us, to take the form of a slave to rescue us from sin. Let's see here. Is it an intellectual cop-out to say God always existed and has no creator? Perhaps he is the creator of one universe among many, all of which have their own gods. Perhaps his power seems unlimited relative to ours, but at his scale, it is not. Well, you're right. There could be the case that our universe was the product of a finite but extremely powerful creator. The problem is, this just kicks the can down the road. You're going to eventually, when you ask what caused X, you only have really three options. Either there's an infinite series of causes, there is a final cause, or there is no cause whatsoever. Okay. It's kind of like our discussion on Agrippa's trilemma in epistemology in the Dyer debate debrief, if you think about it. Infinite, no explanation, you could add maybe circular, but really that ends up being no explanation at all, or a final ultimate explanation. So if the creator of the universe say, our universe is just a simulation and we are in a box in another universe, in somebody's lab. Well, who made that lab? Who made that universe? It's another simulation. Infinite simulations don't explain anything any more than infinite links in a chain don't explain why a chandelier is hanging above me if the links in the chain aren't connected to anything. So it's not a cop-out to say, look, it can't be infinite, can't be no explanation, has to be final. What are the? And then we would try to discern the divine attributes of this final creator, final cause, if you will. Would the children of baptized parents be born without the stain of original sin? Why or why not? They would be born with the stain of original sin because even though their parents have been baptized, and so their parents have received sanctifying grace to be restored in friendship with God that Adam and Eve lost, baptism does not undo the flaws in human nature. It does not undo the effects of original sin in human nature. And those effects are still passed on. The other problem is that, so those effects are still passed on in the body. And the other reason is that our souls don't come from our parents. They come from God. There is a view in theology that's popular among Protestant theologians called Traducianism, Traducianism, Traducianism. It means branching. The idea is that your soul, parts of your soul, come from your parents. And people will say that has to be that way because otherwise God gives you your soul. And then how does your soul have original sin if the soul comes straight from God? Well, first, your soul doesn't come from your parents because souls don't have parts. I can't have half an immaterial soul from dad and half from mom because, well, souls don't have parts. That's why souls don't die. That's why why the soul is immortal. The soul is directly created by God. That's what the catechism says. But the moment the soul is infused into the body, however, it is stained, if you will, or it's infected kind of by the absence of grace that is present in the human nature that is received, the human body that is received from one's parents, because we still have the effects of original sin. Even though we are baptized, we're going to die. That isn't undone. So while the souls of your parents through baptism are united to God, they do not have the ability to pass that on through physical generation to their children. That's why we baptize infants, that they are given a soul from God, but because they have a body that has come through a process stained by human nature and sin, original sin is present and baptism is necessary to remove it unless God undertakes some kind of miraculous intervention to prevent that from happening, like we see with Christ's conception in his womb, obviously, and the Immaculate Conception of Mary in the mother, sorry, in the womb of her mother, Saint Anne, that God intervene, that Christ intervenes there to prevent what naturally would be the origination of original sin by preemptively giving grace to his mother at the moment that she was conceived. Let's see. If a married Catholic got a vasectomy in order to prevent having more children, what would need to happen if later he and his wife wanted to get back in line with church teaching? They would need to go to this. Well, he, depending on who was involved in the decision, would need to go to the sacrament of reconciliation and seek reconciliation with God go to confession, basically. You would not be morally obligated, though, to undergo a reversal of the vasectomy. You certainly could. That would be very praiseworthy. However, it's not guaranteed that even a reversal of a vasectomy, there are risks that are involved in the procedure. It's not a guarantee that it'll be successful either. You'd have a similar analogy to a wife who got a tubal ligation, aka having one's fallopian tubes tied. So you wouldn't be morally obligated to undergo a vasectomy reversal in order to be forgiven or anything like that. It would be praiseworthy, but you wouldn't be obligated to undergo some kind of an extraordinary procedure like that. But it's something to consider. That's why it's also something to consider not to do these things in the first place, to physically alter one's body. I remember my book, Made This Way, my co-author, Layla Miller, talked to an air conditioning repairman and about having kids. And she had, you know, I think like 6 or 7 at the time. And he said, "Oh, I'm glad I got fixed." And she asked him, "What, were you broken?" And it kind of stuck with him. Like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have done that to me. I actually did break myself rather than, you know, fertility is the one thing in the modern world that we consider an illness that stands in need of treatment versus anything else. Do you think dreams are inherently meaningful or just neural static? It could be both. I think sleep's kind of a mystery. We don't really understand why we sleep, why we need it, what it does. But I think dreams are just a way that sometimes the synapses in our brain need to fire to stay healthy, and they don't have to fire in any particular direction to keep them healthy. Like our brain can't like randomly fire while we're awake because, you know, I'm waving my arms around. Like, that would be weird if my brain did that, you know, and that would be bad. But maybe when I'm sleeping, my synapses just have to fire a bunch to stay healthy. And that's kind of why when you fall into a sleep state, your body undergoes a kind of paralysis. You switch over, I'm going to fail bio here. I think you switch over from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system. Or maybe it's vice versa, I can't remember. But that's why what's scary is sometimes you can awake, you can become conscious, but still be on the other nervous system, and that's called sleep paralysis. And you're awake, but you can't move, and that's scary. So I think it makes sense, like our body undergoes a natural paralysis, so the synapses fire. So even if we would be jerking all around, we normally wouldn't be. So I think that dreams, when we look in scripture, well, one, personal experience in scripture, I think sometimes, you know, you eat McDonald's too late at night, like some people who shall remain nameless that host this podcast. And you get weird dreams after that. It's kind of like static chemicals in your body working together. Sometimes, though, scripture talks about, Paul says that he saw a vision of a man from Macedonia, calling him to go to Macedonia. He called it a vision in the night. And that'd be a dream. Joseph had a dream, you know, St. Joseph, most chaste spouse of Mary, and the patriarch Joseph. And, you know, he didn't have the dreams. The patriarch Joseph was the interpreter of Pharaoh's dreams. So I do believe that God can send us messages in dreams. Take it with a grain of salt, though, because it's very easy to have McDonald's dreams, not dreams about McDonald's. Maybe you do. But, you know, it's always don't go overboard. I think a lot of times it's just your brain firing to get the synapses working right. Take it all with a grain of salt or just don't take it at all. But sometimes God can use dreams to really inspire us. That's where we have to have a deep prayer life to see if and discern if this is from God and it's helping us to go in the right direction. Let's see what else we have here. Hello, Trent. I just recently bought David Boonen's A Defense of Abortion. I plan to read it after I finish the book I'm currently on Any suggestions how to analyze Bunin's work are from the other side of the issue. David Bunin is one of the premier philosophers that has defended legal abortion. He has a newer book called Beyond Roe. Hopefully I'll review it for the podcast here soon. He and I debated several years ago at Stanford University. I would just say to engage Bunin's defense of abortion is old. It's almost 20 years old. I can't believe it's almost 20 years old. This feels like yesterday I bought the book and it had just come out a few years ago. That was in 2003. Great, but since then there have been a lot of great rebuttals to Bunin in the work of Patrick Lee, Christopher Kazor, K-A-C-Z-O-R, Frank Beckwith. Their books have all engaged Bunin, his earlier work, very, very well. I think my debate and my book, Persuasive Pro-Life, also do that. Check those out. I'm not familiar with as newer critiques of his bodily rights argument in Beyond Roe, but if I find them, I'll share them on the podcast, or I might share my thoughts on that. Let's see. Do we have any others? I'll take this one, last one. Hey, Trent, I want to start studying philosophy. Are there any good books you recommend for beginners, particularly on logical fallacies? When it comes to logic, Peter Kraft has a wonderful book called Socratic Logic. He also has, I think, Socrates meets the philosopher, Introduction to Philosophy with Socrates. Kraft has wonderful stuff on that. I will confess to you, I'm not really aware of just a really solid Catholic introduction to philosophy. There was a book by, I think it was Daniel Sullivan, it was written many, many decades ago. Catholic Introduction to Philosophy, I think is what it was called. And it's fine. It's serviceable. It's very hard to write a good introduction to philosophy for a layperson to understand. It's either boring or technical or not helpful or doesn't go deep enough or goes too deep. So I think Socratic Logic and the stuff by Kraft is a great introduction. A lot of my philosophical work is when reading, I took Philosophy 101 in college and read more secular like introductions to philosophy. I think if you look up the Great Books program and read a lot of the books there, Plato, Socrates, Augustine, Cicero, you're like, well, am I going to have to read the whole Summa of Aquinas? No. That's why, yeah, I've always hoped and have thought about maybe writing an introduction to philosophy. But I have a unique way of doing it, different from how the other people have done that. But otherwise, I know there was an anthology of Catholic works of philosophy. Pat Lee might have been one of the editors of that anthology. I'm gonna have to go and check that out. But Kraft's Socratic Logic is good, at least for fallacies and basic thinking. And then for the other stuff, check regular primers, just regular anthologies of philosophy. It's a good thing to get familiar with the basic terms and people. Then cross-reference it with really solid Catholic philosophers, David Oderberg, Alex Pruss, Rob Koons, Ed Fazer. Lots of great people out there for you to consider. Ed Fazer has a wonderful blog, actually, that I would highly recommend. All right. Well, thank you, guys. I hope that was all very helpful for you all. It was great to finish out the questions. So many questions I could not get to. Sorry if I didn't get to your question. Hopefully we'll be able to maybe get to it in a future episode. But yeah, thank you guys so much. And I hope that you all have a very blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.